Welcome to Crosstalk, the number one podcast in the whole universe. I love saying that. Please like, subscribe, and comment. Get in touch with us if you need help or if you have a loved one who, you know, you don't know what to do with. We do want your comments. We do want to help people. That's the point of the podcast, is to raise awareness on addiction, recovery, you know, whether it's suicide prevention, things like that. Like, we really want to help people, and that is the point. So get in touch. Today, I have Ray, who is an amazing friend of mine. I have known Ray for 8 years. It'll be 8 years in November that I know you, which is so exciting. And time flies, and I'm getting older.
Me too.
So welcome. Thank you so much for coming.
Of course, absolutely. It's my pleasure.
So, as you may know, on Crosstalk, we kind of go through people's stories and talk about, you know, how they grew up, what happens, when did it all get a little messy, how messy did it get, share as little or as juicy as you want, and then how did it all get better, and what your life looks like, what your life looked like in early recovery, what your life looks like now, you know, because it has been for you, I don't know, maybe 9 years?
8 years.
8 years, okay, yeah. So we're on the kind of the similar track. You know, a lot changes from early recovery to 8 years later. So let's definitely cover all of that.
Sure.
Welcome. So tell me how it all began.
Oh, so it all began. I was born.
Oh, okay.
yep. I think that's where things got messy first. So I was born in 1988 in May, and I was put up for adoption. Okay. My family went through an adoption agency. I had an older brother. There's about 13 year age difference between us. And so I stayed basically with a nurse for the first 3 months until all of the adoption went through. And then I came home. I do know that my parents pulled my brother out of high school for that day when they got me, and they were super excited. So, yeah, I think that's really where it kind of got messy first. And the reason why I say that is because now, as an adult, I'm aware of kind of all of the wounding that I had.
They say, you know, like, adoption is the primal wound.
Is that
how the saying goes?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So there's actually a phenomenal book, and it's called Primal Wound.
Oh.
About adoption. And I read it in treatment, and it was life-changing for me.
So tell me, why is it called the primal wound?
Yeah. So there's a belief system that scientifically, you know, there's a really strong connection that a birth mother has with the child, not just kind of genetically and chromosomally, but also emotionally. And so they talk about adoption being that first separation or kind of severing of attachment and connection.
Wow.
And so that's why they kind of call it the primal wound, and why you'll see a lot of times people struggle with attachment and connection to other people. Because if you look really, really early on in infancy, there was kind of that separation. And that was absolutely factual for me. But I didn't know that it was factual for me until I got sober and I went to treatment and I learned about adoption and how it impacted me. I grew up always knowing that I was adopted. There was never kind of this moment where a bomb went off. I just kind of remember growing up knowing that I had been adopted.
Okay.
And so I was told pretty early on. I think that I was in elementary school, and I was curious, you know, of you know, babies come from, the age-old questions that elementary school kids ask. And that's when I was sat down, and my parents basically described, you know, we felt like something was missing. We wanted another child, and we were lucky to get you. So learning that I was adopted wasn't necessarily traumatic for me.
Did you feel something was different?
I did.
Okay.
Yeah, I did, because I was so different
Okay.
than my family. there were down to interests. My family is very book smart. Both of my parents were professors, and my brother was very book smart. And I would have much preferred to be climbing trees and rolling in mud and in the dirt and kind of all of those things. And I was super energetic. I was diagnosed with ADHD when I was young, so I think about 7. So I really always struggled with tons of difficulty with remaining focused. I struggled in school. I needed tutors and special classes. And so I think the stacking of being different started when I was young. All right. So, you know, to be so different from my family, but also being adopted was kind of my first lesson in, wow, Ray, there's something different about you than other people, and I just don't know what it is. So, you know, one of the things that I really struggled with was needing extra help in school. So I was diagnosed with challenges with learning, math, English, things like that. And so, you know, kind of needing that extra help mm-hmm. was shameful for me.
I was very much tutor, had a lot of learning stuff too, and I needed the tutoring and extra help and everything. So that was like very prevalent in my school, like the special ed course, like where everyone went to get like untimed. I don't know if it's because we were like really bad kids or whatever, but we all got extra time on tests and things. So that was a prevalent thing in your like, that was really...
Yeah.
A major, you remember that a lot.
I do.
Okay.
Because I remember growing up knowing that my family learned with such ease. You know, there was such a focus on academics and studying and reading, and I had zero interest in that.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think the internal message that I gave to myself was, you know, I'm stupid or I'm dumb because I'm not like my family or other people that I saw really excel.
Which is quite the opposite.
Now I know that.
Right, right.
And as a kid, you know, and that was a narrative that I had for most of my life until I got sober. And I think that it was actually a narrative that played into my use. You know, I was just different. And I really think that I took that I'm different and ran with it.
So how did that progress? So now like you're getting older, learning is definitely something different for you. And how were you behaviorally? Were you, you know, like a bad kid?
I think my bad kid era started in middle school.
Okay.
So in elementary school, I was
And I say bad kid. I don't know. That's probably a not a good thing to say. I don't know.
I don't mind
but, you
it.
Know, just, yeah, naughty, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. I don't mind it. I think I reveled in being the bad kid.
Right.
Actually, it fulfilled this kind of piece of me, which is, you know, I'm stupid, therefore.
Like the self-fulfilling prophecy.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah. And I wanted to be, you know, this person that I was searching to create my own identity. And I was a late bloomer with using. Mm-hmm. Most of my challenges early on were behavioral, where there was a ton of rage and anger and, you know, a history. I think the we'll call it our bad kid era.
Okay.
It feels powerful. I don't know. But I think the challenge in middle school was that's when puberty starts. I didn't have many friends. I grew up very religious. In a very religious household, which was very restrictive for me.
So you're Orthodox Jewish?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you observe the Sabbath? So no lights, no electricity, walking everywhere, going to synagogue, and Shabbat dinners on Friday night, which I love personally.
Yeah.
But okay, so I grew up around that, so I know a lot mm-hmm. about that culture.
Yeah. So I grew up with that, and that's all that I really knew. And I think that that chain, that also played a role in I'm different mm-hmm. Because I went to public school. Most of my friends were not Orthodox Jews. And so all of my friends in middle school and high school would go to the movies Friday night or go hang out at their friends' houses. But I had expectations, lean into faith. And I think that was really tough for me because it never hit for me what I think it hits for other people. Mm-hmm. You know, and another part of my experience was experiencing significant trauma in early childhood. So I think that that also played into being different. Something is not right with me. So having kind of all of those things, right, the learning disabilities, the challenges with school, needing extra time, having tutors, add in trauma, add in religious faith, where there are rules and regulations that you need to follow, I really struggled socially and internally.
Okay.
Yeah.
I can relate to that.
Yeah. I really struggled.
So when did... you know, using come into play in your life?
Yeah. So I was a late bloomer.
Me too, actually, believe it or not.
When did you, how old were you when you started?
My first couple of drinks were when I was younger, like 11. Okay. And then 14, I got taken out of high school in a stretcher because I drank a lot.
Yeah.
Threw up on a teacher, you know, did some fun stuff.
Then sure.
I don't think I've ever made an amends to that teacher. I never found them, but I should maybe look for them. But yeah, but then I didn't really start doing drugs and stuff till I was like 26.
Yeah.
And college drinking, I thought was normal, you know? So I consider myself a late bloomer in terms of how bad it got, but food was my primary addiction. So that was my original drug that, and that's what I used. So, you know,
yeah.
But drugs wise, I think I was a late bloomer.
Yeah. I have a very similar experience where my first, I would say, addiction was to self-harm.
Okay.
So in high school is when self-harm for me and restrictive eating started.
They go
hand in hand.
Hand in hand, right.
Yeah. And it was really my first concept of control. It was something that I was able to control. It was something that I knew the outcome of. And I was always searching for that kind of sense of control in my life. And so self-harm is where it started, and started with, you know, cutting and very big challenges with body image and food and uncertainty in life. And so those two things were really my first drug of choice. And I had a phenomenal English teacher who is still one of my closest friends now.
Wow, that's
yes.
so cool. I love that.
She's awesome. And she was the first person to notice something was off. And so that was my first experience of somebody really kind of saying something is off. There needs to be eyes on this person. You know, at the time I was in high school, so I was like, how dare somebody...
Right. And now we say teachers don't, you know, don't care, don't whatever. Although I do know a lot of teachers that do. So, but that's incredible. That's great that she was able to point that out.
Yeah. And she stepped in and she was present and
you
she was
her
consistent.
At the time.
Correct. I hated her at the time.
Of course.
And I think that was my first kind of internal experience of somebody trying to put a stop on a sense of control and unhealthy behaviors for me. And so, of course, what do most of us do? We buck the system. Mm-hmm. And so it progressed, you know, and I had been seeing a therapist for years at that time. And I think that was really my first experience with just complete dishonesty and deceit. And I learned that I could maneuver and manipulate my way around people and experiences and things to get what I needed. And so really in high school, things really started to flourish. I looked so forward to going to college because internally it was, I can do whatever I want. I don't have to follow rules and regulations. I don't have to have eyes on me. I can experience whatever it is that I want to experience. And so I went to college, and I went to college on Long Island, and which is a party area. You know, you're close to Manhattan, you're close to the city, you just take the train in. And,
right.
So here's this kid who has had a very restrictive life. And when I say restrictive, I want to emphasize that I had so many wonderful experiences and, wonderful, things in life. And I felt that because of the religion, you know, and the expectation that was placed on academics, what that I had no interest in, it was restrictive.
Right. I mean, both can be true. Just because you felt your life was restrictive in terms of like not being able to go to the movies with your friends on a Friday night. Like I had Greek school every day after school while all my friends were going to the diner or playing sports or things like that. That doesn't mean I didn't have a great childhood and my parents loved me and provided me with every single thing. But did I feel left out from certain activities? Of course. So both can be true. And I think that that's really hard for other people to understand that just because you say one thing doesn't mean that everything was all bad or everything was bad at all. Yeah.
And the two can coexist together. And it can, and that exact kind of knowledge was really confusing for me.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I didn't learn that cognitive, like, or DBT thing, the and instead of the but. You know, and I use it now, but I learned that in sobriety, you know, that, oh my God, I could have two feelings at once. Like, what do you mean? You know?
And it's confusing for a middle school, high school kid.
For sure.
And it produced anger for me. You know, one of the things, and it's funny that you say that because I remember doing my first fourth step, and on my first fourth step was one of the biggest resentments that I had was that I was late to prom because of the Sabbath. And so I was like, you know, I don't understand why this can't be an exception. This is something that's so important to me. And so college,
you don't have to celebrate
anything. I can do whatever I want.
You have weekends free.
Correct.
Okay.
I can do whatever I want. And, you know, the interesting thing I think is that now that I look back, I can see the enabling pattern. So, my mom was very big on making sure that I got the help that I needed. So she was the one that was kind of the advocate and the bulldozer for me in college. And, you know, because she taught, she would often review my essays, help me register me for classes. So I was like freedom, right? I didn't have to, and everything was done for me.
Right.
So I didn't have to worry about anything. It was also my first experience of like significant bullying. So
wow.
I was, yeah,
college.
My freshman year. So I was bullied for sure in middle school and high school, but in general.
I feel like
everybody does at some point. But
I think
general,
I was bullied and I think I bullied. Sure. You know, I think I definitely bullied too. And that's so sad to say, but it's true, you know, and hurt people. It makes sense, you know?
A lot of my anger was internal, you know, so I was very mousy in school, you know, like really kind of quiet, unless I was with my core group of friends. And so I'm sure that I bullied people. I think more so it was just for me, really this internal
protect.
Yeah. And,
protect.
Shut down and kind of cower down. But freshman year, 100% was my first experience with outwardly being bullied. So, you know, I made a couple really close friends who are still good friends of mine today, one in particular. I was bullied my freshman year, tormented, and it was miserable. And that is my first experience with substances. So I went to the bars. My university was right on a strip and there were a list of bars. And so people would bar hop on the weekends. And I thought that that was normal. And so because I didn't have...
It's not?
I think it is, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that was really... The biggest problem was I had no reference of I should or shouldn't do this. My life was so kind of restricted and compact that I had zero reference of what I should or shouldn't do.
Okay.
And so that was where I had my first kind of experience with alcohol. I wasn't the biggest fan of alcohol. Really where it spiraled for me, and I did go out on the weekends. You know, I would drink on the weekends and there were a couple of times that I ended up in some fountains. Mm-hmm. And not know I guess I wanted to go swimming.
Right.
But for the most part, and scholastically I did okay. My freshman year, my sophomore year is what we call my $40,000 mistake. Okay. Yeah. So right around that summer, I was involved in a car accident on one of the highways. I believe it was my sophomore year. And I was given Percocets from the hospital for neck and back pain. And that is where I kind of had my aha moment. Because the numbing feeling and the warm feeling that I got from it was like comfort. Right. And that, now that I look back, was where my brain 100% flipped over and was like, all right, this is it. So I was smoking pot, I was using Percocets, I was drinking, I was mixing all of it together. And I made it through college. My sophomore year, I failed multiple classes, so I had to stay for the summer. I was involved in Greek life. I joined a medical fraternity. And so there, of course, there was, you know, kind of the expectation of drinking, partying. You know, it's a frat, you know, you get hazed and then you do the hazing and all of these things. And so my frame of reference, everything was in its extreme, right? So you have a whole university of kids that are, you know, there's no one watching.
Right.
And things, you know.
It is to black out.
Right. Correct.
Which is outrageous. But.
Right. And I realized that other people didn't do it as frequently as I did. I was also diagnosed at that time with some mental health challenges. And so I was seeing university campus therapists, and there was zero reference for me of what I know now. So I think that I was pretty restrictive, dishonest, manipulative. You know, I was using substances. I made it through and successfully graduated from university. And then I returned home and I got my first job, which was in, you know, social services kind of arena. That is truly where my substance use progressed. Mm-hmm. So at that time I was involved in my first long-term relationship. I was with somebody for about 6 years. I think prior to that was when I went to treatment for the first time.
Okay.
I think that's kind of the time frame. Everything is really hazy.
How old were you at that time?
I believe I was in my very early 20s.
Okay.
So I graduated, secured this like first professional job. I lost that job. I was asked to leave and I was asked to resign because of my behavior and my substance use. I remember the enabling continued. My family came in to try to preserve the position. And, you know, I was like, no, I'm just leaving. I'm going to go to treatment. So I went.
You decided that on your own.
I did.
That's pretty incredible.
It was an escape. I was like, oh my God, the consequences are so bad. I'm so embarrassed. And yeah, absolutely. Send me somewhere.
Okay.
You know,
I never thought of it that way.
Yeah. I was like, yeah, yeah. I'll go wherever you want me to go.
I don't want to be with you.
Right. I just want to go, you know? And I ran away and I went to my first treatment center, which was, Hazelden Betty Ford. Okay. So I went out into Center City, in Minnesota. And am I allowed to swear?
Yeah.
I was a menace in treatment. I tried to rule the roost. I was not serious about my treatment. I loved having food made for me. I loved having housekeeping. I loved, you know, like I loved all of it. Was my purpose for being there was I'm going to get out of these consequences and I'm going to come back and like everybody's going to like forget what happened, you know, and I'll forget what happened. And that was kind of my first experience as well of having consequences in the family unit. There were rules and boundaries that were put in place for me to return home. So I was recommended after treatment to go to sober living. And I was like, I'm not doing that.
Right.
But it was an expectation. So I went to this sober living. It was in this big old mansion, dead of Center City. I didn't know anybody there. I think I was living this fantasy world where I truly believed if I do X, Y, and Z, I'll be allowed to come home and then I can go back to being a menace, basically.
Yeah.
So I didn't like the sober living and I manipulated my family into flying me home. I basically put on the tears, the waterworks, you know, I'm so unhappy. I'll follow whatever rules you want me to follow. I got this. I'm willing to do this. And it worked. And that's important for my story later on. So at that time I manipulated, I broke the boundaries and it worked. So I returned home and I was able to stay abstinent for 5 years.
Wow, that's a lot of time.
It is.
No program, no rooms, no...
So I went to the rooms.
Oh, you did a 12-step?
I was going to meetings. Mm-hmm. I did not work the steps. I did not have a sponsor. But I liked the meetings, and I think I liked it for social reasons. Because internally, I was lonely. I was miserable. I was a dry drunk. There was no concept for me of what true sobriety and recovery looked like. And in upstate New York, there's a phenomenal place for meetings, and I met wonderful people there. I think that I shied away from the people that were really working a program because I was terrified. I didn't want to be
held accountable
or be healthy because everything was working for me in my favor at the time.
Right.
So I had those 5 years abstinent. And during those 5 to 6 years, I was in my first long-term relationship for that entire time. And she's still one of my closest friends to this day and still lives upstate New York and has been a part of my story and my journey this entire time since high school. So I had those 5 years abstinent. I was still a dry drunk. I still had all of my character defects. I was still dishonest, manipulative, unkind, angry. I was a menace.
Yeah.
Basically.
Right.
And so this person stayed with me until she no longer was willing to tolerate my behaviors and she left. And so that was my first awareness of if I do X, Y, and Z, I am going to lose things that are important to me. And prior to that, I didn't care that I was losing things. I didn't care about losing friends or integrity or, you know, hurting people. I didn't, there was no concept for me of action to consequence, right? So I think for me, I really needed all of these consequences. So I needed those consequences to start racking up. So I needed to start losing relationships. I needed to start losing integrity. I needed to have all of these traumatic experiences from behaving in certain ways. I needed to have pain.
Yeah.
And so I would say like from...
Everything was too easy.
Yeah. And I was enabled and I was,
you know... Why change if I don't need to?
Right.
Yeah.
And until adulthood... things worked. And so I started racking up these kind of consequences, these moral injuries, these moral painful experiences. So this person left me and I was left completely heartbroken and totally alone and in this apartment that I couldn't maintain by myself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I started entertaining another relationship with another person pretty shortly after. And this person was also in active addiction. And I thought that I was going to maintain that relationship by being the sober person, right? Mm. So there was this power differential where I was sober and they were not. And so I was this knight in shining armor fixer, all of these things.
You were the healthy one.
Yeah, I was the healthy one. So it seemed.
Yeah.
And pretty quickly, my addiction came back with a vengeance. You know, as we know now, addiction progresses even when you're sober. So this is a disease that continues to progress even when we're sober.
Right.
So,
like if I were to go back and drink tomorrow or go back to the drugs I was using, I would use just as hard, drink just as much. It wouldn't be like I would start with a glass of wine again.
Right.
Right.
Right. But we tell ourselves that.
Oh, I know.
So I started with one Xanax.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, just to help me sleep.
Right.
You know? And then
it progressed. It's not even for sleep, but right.
No, but it made sense to me.
Of course. That's what I used it for.
Yeah. And I started dancing around with drug dealers and people that were not of integrity and people that were dishonest. And it quickly progressed to substantial amount of Xanax and opiates and, you know, muscle relaxers and all of these different things. And so I was a downer's guy. Because I'm anxious as a human being anyway. So anything that would kind of...
Stimulation would make you even more anxious.
Right. And anything that would just kind of bring me down mm-hmm. And basically level me out and just tank me. I wanted to be numb. I wanted to be nodding out on the couch. I wanted to be this person who didn't have to feel anything. I successfully achieved that. You know, I successfully achieved that. And so I was with this person that was actively using and I'm using, and it just completely blew up in my face. And that is where, you know, the seizures started. So the seizures started, and because this person was not well, I was just kind of rolled over and, you know, there was no care or medical care or anything like that. And I would just kind of wake up and do it again. And I thought that was normal. You know, I was living this life of, I had nothing, you know, I would go to the grocery stores to get, you know, pick out cigarettes from that were half smoking to get tobacco. And like, so you're
getting close to bottom at this point.
So I'm definitely getting close to my bottom. So, you know, I'm involved in this really unhealthy relationship. I'm actively using, you know, I'm back, you know, I'm in upstate New York. I started having seizures because of the benzos, and right. I would use and then go through many withdrawals and have seizures. I truly thought that this was kind of the way that I was going to live and die. And the most bizarre thing is that I had no hope. I had accepted that this was my life and I was probably going to die from my drugs of choice. And I was okay with that.
Right. Isn't that such a sad place to be? Like, you don't necessarily want to die, but like, you know, you've kind of resigned to the fact that like you might, and that's okay.
Right. And I'm going to continue to do what I'm doing. The overall effect that substances had on me, was just this complete tanking of my moral, values, mm-hmm. of my hope, of joy, of all of these different things. And I accepted that. So I'm in this really unhealthy relationship and the series of events. And so the person that I had been with for the 6 years that I mentioned earlier was helping me. So there would be times that my clothes weren't clean. I had no clothes. I didn't, you know, I hadn't eaten. I had nothing. And she would bring food and a meal and just let me sit in the car and just right. eat and
try to help you
and have a place that was safe to do that.
Right.
You know, and I think that was really kind of what, you know, and she wouldn't give me money. She would not give me money. And she had learned, I'll bring you food. I'll give you cigarettes. I'll do these things, but I'm not giving you money.
Right. Cause you're not going to buy food or help yourself, you're going to buy more drugs. And that's kind of like where we're at that time, you know, through no fault of our own, really through what's taken over.
Right.
Yeah.
So I was involved in a series of accidents and the person that I was with had children. And, you know, I won't go into too much detail about that. However, that was part of my bottom. Was driving under the influence, risking other people's safety, risking my safety.
Yeah.
All of these things.
That's a common thread.
Yeah.
It's a very common thread. You know, I mean, people do it all the time. They leave like a barbecue and they've drank. They don't realize that it can turn at any moment, you know?
And so that clicked for me. Right. Because there's innocence. Right. And so I couldn't sit with myself knowing that I was placing other people at risk. I didn't care about myself, but I cared enough about, you know, the kids or, you know, someone else or friends. And so that's what really kind of started the wheelhouse to turn. Mm-hmm. You know, and this whole time enabled, right? You know, I was so high that, you know, my face fell into a bowl of Lucky Charms.
Oh my God, my face fell into a bowl of Chinese food.
Yeah.
On Christmas Day.
Yeah.
I think it was Christmas Day. Yeah, Christmas Day.
Yeah.
Oh.
I almost drowned in milk, you know, like genuinely.
I'm sorry I'm laughing. It's like not funny, but it
just, yeah.
This theme of laughter comes up in these interviews because other people are like, why are you laughing? But we have to laugh. Like if we don't laugh, like about drowning in Lucky Charms,
right,
then like, where's it at?
Yeah. Like, and I was okay with that.
Yeah.
I remember like coming to and having my face pulled back and I'm like, wow, I almost just died in milk.
Yeah. And then you're like,
and like, I have marshmallows stuck to my head and I just like continue to eat,
right?
You know, and I continue to use and, you know, like it's, you know, I would have been very upset if I died by Lucky Charms.
Right.
You know, oh God, that would have just, you know, that would have been terrible. But that's the concept of where I was that, you know, I was okay nodding out into a giant bowl of Lucky Charms. And it's not even like a small bowl. It was like a mixing bowl.
Oh yeah.
Why I had a mixing bowl, I'm not sure.
Because sometimes those are good bowls to eat cereal out of. And that's the bowl companies out there.
I will. I'll still validate that.
Yes.
Yeah. Cereal tastes better in a mixing bowl.
In a bigger bowl. Yeah.
Right. That or like a blender. I did that
like
once
a bowl.
Too.
Like it needs to be like that.
Right. Yeah. And like, you know, factually, you know, my risk of dying by Lucky Charms was far higher using than it is, you know, now.
Right.
You know, but I truly and genuinely was like breathing in milk and like actively drowning. And so that was another kind of thing where I'm like,
did anyone witness it?
Yeah, the person that I was with.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did they go to your family?
No.
No. Okay.
No. I mean, they were actively using as well.
But just not as much.
No, they were using as much, just other substances.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's these two really full-blown active users living in a home together. It was terrible.
Yeah.
It was terrible. You know, so I'm drowning in milk and Lucky Charms. I'm driving under the influence. I'm involved in accidents, with innocents in the car. You know, there's toxic household, all of these things. And I think for me, I started to get scared, not necessarily scared that I was going to die, but scared that I was going to lose my sanity. I was truly terrified that I was going to lose every last piece of myself. And that was scary for me. You know, I had grown up having whatever I needed and whatever I wanted. I had grown up with people that are educated and academics and in a good home. And the way that I was living was so incongruent to any of that. I think still to this day, that was kind of my biggest internal struggle was, why is the way that I am so starkly different from the way that I want to be and the way that I was expected to grow up? When I'm in active addiction, that is my fuel to continue to use. When I'm in sobriety, that is my reason to stay sober. Mm-hmm. And so it's when my disease is active, I'm going to get high because I'm so different.
Right.
And in sobriety, it's, I want to be sober because my authentic self is more of that of my family's values.
So what happened at this point? Who stopped you? Did you stop? Mm-hmm. You stopped yourself?
I did.
Okay.
Yes.
And what'd you do?
I Googled luxury treatment centers.
Oh, yeah. Good
and I was like, you know, if I'm going to go somewhere, like I want it to be good.
Yeah.
And like, I want it to be bougie.
Did Where We Go come up?
Yes.
Oh God, really?
Yes.
I mean, it is a very nice place.
It is a very nice place.
But
I
don't think the luxury that you thought
that I was getting was not
the same luxury.
Correct.
Beautiful place, great apartments, great, you know, all of that, the best therapists, like
yes.
all, especially at the time, you know, and then But you're thinking massages.
Correct.
You're thinking yoga on the beach.
Correct.
Maybe an Olympic size swimming pool.
The Olympic size swimming pool is what got me.
Yeah.
Right. You know, yes.
Yeah.
I don't know what I was looking for. I just knew that I was looking to get out.
Mm-hmm.
And so I looked up luxury treatment centers. Where I went came up, and it was, you know, the Magic Mountain. And that was luxury.
You're lucky you got to go to Magic Mountain, actually, because I recently went for the first time.
It's wonderful.
And it is magic.
Yes.
And I was like, whenever people are like, oh, you know, Magic Mountain, which is Karen, you know,
yep.
I hope that's okay that I say that.
Yeah,
we've
yeah.
already said Karen a million times on this podcast.
Yes.
Like, we might as well, like, no, we do not work for them.
We should have a sign, though.
I mean, they need to start paying me, really.
Yeah, yeah.
But,
flags.
You know.
I can raise it down here and be like, Karen.
Right, right, right. But, and people would say, oh, you didn't go to PA? Oh, that it's so magical. And mm-hmm. I was like, you guys, enough with the magical, right?
Right.
It's a treatment center. Like, yeah. please stop.
Yeah.
It is magical. I
yes.
cried. I was moved literally a couple times. It's just a really incredible, there's mm-hmm. a lot of good energy there. A lot
yes.
of like, you feel it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. And they have so many incredible
programs
and places
yeah.
to go.
Yeah.
And
I mean, the one in Florida is great too, but it's not as magical, I would say.
Sure.
Yeah.
yeah.
They're much nicer.
Yeah, there's a different air.
Yeah.
And I think that's because that's where the detox is. It's people that are really in crisis, critical
condition. Yeah.
And so the air needs to be different.
Yeah.
So I asked my mom, I said, I want to go to treatment, and will you pay for this? And she said, absolutely. And I'm forever grateful for that, you know, that I was set up in life to have those opportunities mm-hmm. to go to Hazelden and to go to Karen and get those experiences.
Yeah.
So I went to the Magic Mountain. I detoxed. I think I was there for 10 days, maybe,
mm-hmm.
maybe even less. And I manipulated my way into getting my phone saying that I had to pay bills and look at my finances.
Oh, I tried that.
Blah, blah, blah.
And I was, my phone.
And I was given my phone and I snuck it and I kept it and I left AMA. So I had people come.
I didn't know that.
I did. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I was terrified.
Who came to get you in the middle of nowhere?
Random people that I was friends
with.
They
didn't send me there because they thought I would AMA.
Yeah.
And now that I've been there, I was like, you think I would have left there in November? I was freezing. I would never
yeah.
have walked.
I went in May.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So it was summer.
Okay.
You know? So yeah, I called these two random people that I had known and they drove like the 5 hours to come and get me and then drove me the 5 hours to go back.
Those are some nice friends.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I had nothing to offer them other than humor.
Right.
You know, and
luckily we're charming.
Right. Yeah. And so I go home. They drop me off at my ex's place. And I sat on the front stoop until morning. And then I was allowed back in. I want to say that that was the start of the end
okay.
for me.
Okay.
I needed one more run.
So let's go through that run because I really want to also get to kind of what life looked like in sobriety.
Yes.
And so tell me.
So basically my life blew up in my face. I had to go back to treatment. I almost died. And I was allowed back to the Magic Mountain. And
okay.
that was the start of my life. I went through the most difficult detox, and I was told that I was going to be shipped to South Florida. I went kicking and screaming. I had to be escorted to South Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say my first 2 weeks there, I was a menace. That's my favorite term for myself.
Okay.
And they were patient. And that I think is where I had the spiritual change. I found a sponsor and he changed my life. I went through really intensive trauma work. I went through really intensive...
this is up there or down here?
Down here.
Okay.
Yeah. I think I surrendered.
Yeah.
And the reason why I surrendered was not because of my own choice. It was because the force with which Karen came in and matched me, I backed down.
Right.
I tried, they pushed.
Right.
I would try to manipulate. There was a barrier.
They knew it.
They knew it.
They were like, sorry, you're not the first.
Yes.
You won't be the last.
And it was the truly the first time that I had anybody
stand up to you
and outweigh me. Yes.
Right.
And, you know, I was forced to surrender until I was able to surrender for myself. And I think when I got my sponsor and I asked my sponsor to be my sponsor was really truly where I was like, I'm fine. I'm surrendering. I'm done.
Yeah.
And so for sobriety, I would say the first 3 years were really tough. The first 3 years was really where I continued to see behavioral challenges, character defects, all of those things, even after I worked
Everyone
my steps.
Everyone talks about that, that, you know, behaviorally, the first few years, it looks yeah. like addiction, but you're just sober.
Right.
Maybe not exactly like addiction, but you know what I mean? Like there's a lot of behaviors that we are not proud of in early yeah. sobriety that like devolve and develop. We can't change overnight. And no. I think that that's like so important for people to realize is like where I'm at has taken 8 years.
Yes.
You know, it's yeah. taken 8 years to get here. A lot of anger, a lot of yelling at people and learning that that's no way to behave.
Sure.
You know, and people loving me and people saying, you know, you're not for me.
Yes.
You know?
And being okay
Your behavior
with it.
Makes you not for me.
Right. And that's okay.
That is okay. That is yeah. okay.
And I think that's the biggest piece for me has been, you know, I truly found a sense of ease in life. I had always been somebody whose spirit was so unsettled. I couldn't sit still. I couldn't be patient. I didn't know how to make an amends. I didn't know how to be a friend. I didn't know how to be a son. I didn't know how to do any of these things. And so it didn't come from a higher power kind of booping me on the nose and saying, you know, like you're healed. It came from watching people that had done it before me. It came from watching the therapists at Renaissance teach me how to love in a healthy way, how to be present in a healthy way, how to challenge myself in a healthy way. I had to truly listen and follow direction.
Oh, me too.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's really cool because you develop, especially from that treatment program, I developed a sense of self-awareness and also holding myself accountable. That I know a lot of people who I've met in the rooms or especially not as much now, but, you know, when I was in early sobriety and I was like, wow, you really didn't get the same therapy I did. You didn't get the same treatment I did because we weren't necessarily hugged back to eventually we were given that hug.
Sure.
But to get that hug, we had to really change, prove ourselves like, I was met with confrontation.
Yes.
Like, oh, you're going to yell at us, be mean to us. Well, right back.
Right.
You know? And I needed that.
I did too.
Yeah. And people are afraid of that today.
Yeah.
And parents don't want that for right. their kids. But I think that our parents didn't want that either. They didn't know, I guess,
yeah.
all that was going on. And
I needed it.
Yeah, me too.
And I think it, you know, that reminds me, that was the first time, and I think I mentioned it earlier in the podcast, was how I was always able to manipulate my way to getting what I wanted. Mm-hmm. When I got to South Florida, my mom set the first boundary, which was, you can choose to leave, but you will be homeless in the streets of South Florida. I am not flying you home. You may not come home. I am not giving you money. I am not doing any of these things that I thought that I knew I could do.
Right.
And it broke my spirit.
Right. Well, they tell us all that and they tell the parents to hold true to that.
Yes.
You know, I remember when I got kicked. Well, I was asked to leave mm-hmm. on friendly terms. I went back like a month later to finish, but, you know, on friendly terms. my parents didn't talk to me at first. And I was like, what are you doing? Hello. You know, and they were like, they told us that you're not doing well, you know, and you're not. And mm-hmm. I was like, but I'm still sober, you know, but they taught our parents to hold a boundary.
Yes.
So that we can't manipulate them again, because mm-hmm. they don't realize it, but the enabling kills people, you yes. know, enabling kills people.
Yeah. And that's the hardest thing, I think, for parents to realize, is that you're doing the complete opposite of what feels natural to you.
Wow.
But it saves lives.
I know. And now I think with fentanyl, what's so scary is that it may not.
Correct.
You know, that stopping enabling, sometimes you'll die the next day.
Right.
You know, and both enabling and not, it's just a scary world out there with fentanyl.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it continues to progress and get worse.
Well, actually, apparently fentanyl use is down.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's because more Narcan is up and we're hearing less cases. So they're selling more Narcan. So,
yeah, that could be it.
So we don't hear about the overdoses as much because there's a lot more Narcan out there and a lot more knowledge.
That could be it.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
I mean, saving a life is saving a life.
Yeah.
So tell me what life, I know you have your master's.
I do.
And you have an incredible practice.
Yes.
That you help people as well.
Yes.
And so tell me what your life looks like today. Like, what do you do for your own recovery? How do you maintain mm-hmm. what you so worked for so much?
Sure. So for my recovery now, I still have sponsees and yeah. I still go to meetings. So for me, my meeting attendance looks different mm-hmm. now than it did when I was in early sobriety. So I would say for the first 5 years, I really dug in and I would go to about 3 meetings a week. Mm-hmm. And then for year kind of 6-7, it really looked like going to 1 a week, sometimes 1 or 2 every 2 weeks, depending,
mm-hmm. yep.
Depending on schedule. The challenge, the one thing that has been consistent and persistent for me has been being a sponsor. So I have always had active sponsees. Mm-hmm. I continue to have active sponsees. For me, that's the biggest thing, because this 12th step is service work.
100%.
And so the other big piece has been separating my work from my program. I just opened my own private practice, and I work in treatment. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it can be hard to...
Oh, do you still work at a treatment center?
I do.
Well? Oh, okay. That's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
And so I do that. And the biggest thing that I have always been taught is that that's not my program.
Right.
So even though I work in substance use, that is not my program. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty strict about that.
Yeah. You have to be.
Yeah, you have to be. I meditate. I pray.
My favorite thing is meditation. Everyone knows. I love it.
I tend to fall asleep.
Oh, I do too sometimes. But and that's like the best kind.
Yeah. Yeah. So I do that. I think the biggest thing too is like regular therapy. I go to therapy every week mm-hmm. To, you know, have checks and balances. I do supervision to have checks and balances. Mm-hmm. The biggest thing is integrity and operating with integrity. Mm-hmm. And I think my program now and what I'm sure you've heard this, my life now is far greater than I ever could have imagined that it was. And I didn't believe that 8 years ago. You know, I truly thought that my life was going to be maybe, you know, a little bit better than it was in active addiction. And there was a lot of hopelessness in my early sobriety because I would see all of these people that were so successful and so just, you know, crushing it. And I didn't believe that I would be capable of doing that. And now here I am 8 years later, and I feel like I'm kind of in my prime
yeah.
Of my life, just kind of emotionally, spiritually, career-wise, life-wise. You know, I think the most beautiful thing that I'm able to do now is to show up as kind of a caregiver for my mom. Mm-hmm. I'm able to be present.
Is she still living up north?
No, she's down here.
Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah.
Where does she live?
She's out in West Palm.
Oh, how nice.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so, nice.
So I get to see her every week. And, you know, I get to help show up for her and be responsible and trustworthy and honest and of integrity. All of things that I was not.
Right, of course.
For
a long time.
A really long time. You know, I'm a responsible dog dad. I maintain a home. I maintain career.
Friends.
I mean, those are all crazy concepts. you know, my anniversary was recent. It was this past Tuesday.
Oh my God. Happy anniversary.
Thank you.
Happy anniversary.
8 years and May 21st was 8 years and
happy anniversary.
Thank you. Yeah.
That's so cool. I mean, I've seen you transform. You came before me, but you know, and I looked up to you. But I've still seen that transformation from 3 years. You know, I could say that like 5 years ago, you were not the same person you are in front of me today. And I wasn't the same person either. And it's so cool. I think that's my favorite part of this is just seeing people transform from, you know, the hopelessness and the, I mean, besides like looking terrible, right?
Sure.
We come in looking terrible. It's like a physical transformation, but it's also this spiritual, emotional, like personal. You hear people speaking differently.
Yeah.
Like there's almost like a sense of ease and calmness about them, which is what I feel. Mm-hmm. I love that. That's one of my most favorite things about being sober is like the sense of like
peace,
like no chaos, no drama.
Yes.
Oh, it's great.
Right.
Yeah.
And rejecting chaos and drama
that
may try to kind of infiltrate. It's maintaining that, you know, maintaining a space of safety and security and being okay.
Yeah.
You know, where I used to chase chaos and insanity, now I
run.
Me too. Yeah.
Me too. So tell me, if you could go back and ask your younger self or tell your younger self something, how old would that younger self be? What do you picture in your mind? And what would you say?
I think I picture myself being 5 or 6.
Okay.
And I think that I would just kind of tell myself, things are going to be really hard and then it's going to be really beautiful. Just walk through it.
Right. That's all we can do.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a famous kind of saying, and everybody's seen the video, you know, it's Brené Brown. And she says, you know, we as children are hardwired for struggle, but we are worthy of love and belonging. And that is, I think, the experience of sobriety and active use is that our brains are hardwired for struggle and pain and difficulty, but we are worthy of recovery and love and belonging.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming.
You're welcome.
I'm so honored that you came and I'm happy that I got to see you today. I'm excited for your anniversary and one more year doing all this hard work and we just continue to grow, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't stop.
Yeah.
Like what was good last year will be better next year.
Correct. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right, let's hug.